I'm Dan Erlander, and this is the first session of We Are a Man of People. Tonight's the birth of the man of people. I like to phrase that even another way and just call it come to the birthing room. Come to the birthing room. So now I would like to introduce this topic tonight by just telling you how my search and my journey kind of led me to this topic. And basically the topic is tracing the manna story in the Exodus all the way through the Bible. And sometimes it's called eating your way through the Bible. I've also called it divine table manners. But we're going to look at God's people and how God's people received bread and shared bread all through the ages that are represented in the Bible. The concern about this began in an interest in liturgy and in worship. And some of you might remember that probably in the late 60s and the early 70s, we had an intensification of young people and confirmation students saying this, worship is boring. Do you ever remember that?
Last week.
And maybe the difference in the late 60s, early 70s is that we were just running all around trying to do something about it. And so what I remember the things we brought in at that time to kind of fix it up, and there were all kinds of different directions. Some thought if we get enough banners going, that's going to do it. So if you remember church buildings where there wasn't a space without a banner, and then we had balloons, and then we brought in guitars. And remember that day, if you're old enough, when the first guitar came in. And all of these different ways to solve the problem of worship being boring. And then there were other ways to go. Some said, let's be more sentimental. Others said, let's sing songs that are more in keeping with kind of what's interesting to American people. And then there were the so-called liturgical archaeologists who said, if we can only recreate 12th century worship, then that's going to be interesting. So they came in. So you had some people coming in with kind of vibrato organs with lights going on and off, with great emotion, surrounded by banners, balloons, guitars, or somebody coming in with a chasuble swinging incense. And we are all going to fix the liturgy so it would be interesting. And then the confirmation students would come and say, Pastor, it's really fun to go to church. Well, what happened then is year after year after year, all the new stuff became boring. And have you ever heard a worn-out folk group kind of 20 years later strumming the guitars and everybody singing, you know, we are one. And now we're wearing out on that one. So then, this led me, because I was involved in all of this, and I still think it's wonderful, and I love balloons, and I love banners, and I love color, and I love new forms of music. But I came to ask the question, are we asking deep enough questions about our worship life? And that led to the hardest question is just, what is ritual? You know, what are we doing when we do ritual? And so then I had to seek an answer to that question, what is ritual? And starting with this, that ritual is kind of normally a rather negative word. It's that R word. And, you know, people will say, well, how do we use ritual in kind of a negative way? So,
just sort of going through the motions.
Yeah, you're just going through the, you're just doing ritual. Mm.
Yeah,
it's a perfunctory act. No, it's just ritual. No, or you're too ritualistic. No, I think we've tended to make the word negative. Then I thought, well, what is ritual at its best? And I'm talking here now about community ritual. We have individual rituals, and the simple definition of them is just something you do over and over and over again. And have you ever thought to be thankful for personal rituals? That you don't have to get up in the morning and say, which shoe am I going to put on first? You know, you just do, because it's just something you do over and over. In fact, I bet you can't remember which one you do. But you do it over and over. And again, these are personal rituals over and over. But I'm talking about something a community of people do over and over and over again that somehow binds their life together as a family and as a community. And what's helped me is to draw what I call kind of an hourglass on its side. And kind of like this. And this is a family or community going through history. And what would happen, it would just go like that, and then like that, and then like that. Are you getting it? Okay. Now, a community of people have a value. Or maybe another way is they have a story. And out of these values and out of these stories, comes a way of life. Or in more religious terms, out of this value and out of these stories comes a certain piety. If you're more Protestant, if you're more Catholic, you call it a spirituality. It's kind of the way that a community does things, kind of how they live out their life based on what they believe. And what their values are. Could be called their lifestyle. And well, this came to me one day when a community does ritual. I really asked the question, is this what they're doing? Is it a community takes all of this and then they say, let us stop our normal life at certain times, and let's compress all of this into the form of drama, into the form of poetry, into the form of song, into the form of art. Then let's do this. It's a dramatization of all of this And then, by doing this together, the community really reincorporates itself into this style of life. So then it goes forth from the drama to live those values and that way of life with even deeper dedication and with greater intensity. And then the community stops and does the drama again. And then goes from that drama really reconsecrated in a way. Reincorporated in a way to live that way of life in the world. Okay, I'll give some examples that are, you know, you already know where, maybe already figuring out where I'm going with this, that there would be a difference between living ritual and dead ritual. And this finally leads me to ask the question, does liturgy in the church tend to be boring because we don't have enough balloons? Or is it possible that it's boring because it's out of sync with the way we live? You know, just I'll come back, but that would be okay. I'll go back to what I think is is living ritual in this world. We're becoming more and more aware, I think, of the community in this world of Islam. The word Islam means submission. A follower of Islam is called a Muslim, which means one who submits. One who submits to God. Islam means submission to God. And notice the prayer form. How many times a day is it? Four times a day. The prayer form of a Muslim. What form does their body take? Yeah, kneel, and then face to the ground. And this dramatic movement, body motion of prayer, is the body motion of submission to God. And then by doing that, you really reincorporate yourself even more deeply into the life which is Islam, which is the life of submission to God. Four times a day. Okay, I'll give it. That's an example of a faith community. I'll give another example and then see if you can guess what this is. It's a society that once a year kind of stops its normal life and has a great ritual drama. And here's how it happens. It happens in kind of an amphitheater type of thing. And then thousands and thousands gather there. And then down on the central kind of ritual cultic area, you have two forces, and each force is trying to drive the other way to move, pierce through that other, to move towards a victory. And then this ritual drama is surrounded by rather scantily clad women and flags of the nation of these people that are flying all over the place and then cheering for moving through the frontier into the new land. And they're proclaiming power and victory. And this happens in this ancient society once a year, and that society really stops that day. And then one day they invented television so the entire society could see it, and then each little group that watches it has their own ritual for the ritual. You know, you eat the same thing every year, you have the same people over to your house, you sit in the same place every year, and you set rules. And it is so exciting because it's living ritual. Okay, now, does anybody know what I'm talking about? Do you get it? Anybody want to just be dumb enough to just say it? I mean, what I mean is just by, it's so obvious that to ask what I'm talking about, it's kind of dumb. Super Bowl. But and I'm not, in bringing this up, I'm not being anti-sport. I think if some wonderful people I know who are sports philosophers, you know, and really have showed me the value of sport in society. But what would be, okay, if this is, if America has, I won't use these words here, but if America has a value, if America has a story, by America I mean the United States, the United States has a way of life, a certain lifestyle. Does this event dramatize it in a way by participating in that you really reincorporate yourself to even live this way of life with more intensity? What would the style of life be that's ritualized in this annual event? Competition.
Violence.
Consumerism.
Gaining territory.
Drinking. What
power
is this?
Struggle.
What?
Power struggle.
Aggression. It's real positive.
Sexism.
What, the dignity of women that's practiced in this ritual, or isn't practiced in this ritual.
Success and
goal oriented. Winners and losers. Now, is this living ritual? This once a year event. How is it living ritual?
It's not boring.
That's the first clue. And it is in a way like actors, ritual cultic actors acting out a drama of what the life of this people really is all about. By being deeply involved in that ritual, I think we do reincorporate ourselves to live that even with more fervor. Now, does anybody want, am I being too hard?
It's not that we wouldn't be the only society that has or has had an athletic competition as a central ritual. Even the ancient origins of the Olympics, exactly that. It was a cultic kind of time. And you think of the Mayan ball games, you know, in these courts.
And certainly the Roman amphitheater and Colosseum and the games and the
very cultic origins, kind of decultified.
Now, the next question, I don't want to spoil, watch the Super Bowl, and there's a way, we live in culture and we live in society and we participate. I think, if anything I say is going to watch it with a certain theological eye, too. Or don't watch it. The question now, this gives me an idea of what dead ritual would be. What if by some great Pentecost event, like tongues of fire over the entire nation, the wind of the Spirit blows, and in a matter of weeks, the United States of America becomes a Gandhian society of nonviolence, of cooperation, of the dignity of both sexes, of the great value of cooperation and working together and fitting in both with ourselves and each other, but fitting in to the balance of the entire world and the entire universe. We become that kind of a society. Before that happened, somebody wrote a law that said the Super Bowl must be observed every year exactly as it is being observed. So after this great conversion happens, we say, oh, it's a law, we still have to do it. And just like serving on the jury, you get a little card in the mail saying you have to go. And you go through all of this stuff, but there would be no heart in it. Then I think we would say we are now experiencing dead ritual. Now back to my question about the church. The central ritual act of the Christian church on earth is the Eucharist, the broken bread, the poured wine, the giving of life, the sharing of that bread and that wine equally, the community that happens in the midst of broken bread and poured wine. And if that is not living ritual, is it the ritual's fault, or the very, very hard question, in our daily lives as a society, are we so far from that ritual that it's just dead to us? I want to read from Amos 8. Listen to this, you who crush the needy and reduce the oppressed to nothing, and you who say, when will our new moon be over? This is our new moon religious ritual at the temple place. You know, when is this thing going to ever be over? It seems like it's dragging on forever. So we can go back to selling our corn and cheating the poor. And when will the Sabbath be over so we can get back to marketing our wheat at exorbitant prices? I'm adding some of these, but they're commentary. Well, it's basically these people are sitting in the worship life of Israel and saying, my goodness, I can't wait till this thing is over so I can get back to my daily life of grinding the face of the poor into the dust. Well, that's fun. But why do we have to go through with this? And we're talking about people that are having to put up with ritual that has become dead, because the ritual of Israel was a ritual of a completely different way of life than the people were practicing at the time of Amos. Now, the next question now, is this, we go to this part, is to ask the question of the biblical story. Is there a value and a way of life that comes out of this story that then the community ritualizes to reincorporate itself to live that, I'm going to call it a spirituality or a piety? And by spirituality or a piety, I mean a people lives with God, and then there's a way of life that flows out of that life with God. Is there a way of life for a community of people that is celebrated, practiced, learned, taught, passed on, and ritualized in the whole story of Scripture? That's what then leads me to manna people. That's the introduction. Now, I'm just interested, before we go on, just to some responses. What do you think of what I've said so far? Or how does it hit you? Or am I off or am I on? What do you think of this?
It's really making my brain go, trying to make a lot of connections and things, because it's a lot of the kinds of questions I've been asking myself, but I haven't really found very good resolutions. I've been looking at the worship, corporate worship life, and kinds of attitudes toward it, which are often, why do I need to go to church to do that? Right? I can do all that on my own. I can do that for myself. And there's no sense, there's no value of togetherness, of community. It's not a very valued thing for many people. And I started grappling with that. Now I'm waiting to hear more.
The drama tonight of the Beatitudes, if your heart is beginning even to be attuned to the Beatitudes, and this, when we do one thing when we do ritual and living ritual, it's always ahead of us. You know what I mean? In other words, we've never reached the wondrous lifestyle that we ritualize, but the ritual itself, and this is what in faith we call God's grace, the ritual itself is empowering us and wooing us and calling us, but it begins with a certain in third world it's called conscientization, conversion, a metanoia, a seeing. And if you're beginning to even feel a little the wonder of the way of the life of the Beatitudes, did you notice how tonight the ritual really touched the heart? Anybody? And it was just with a broom. I mean, and a broom became very holy. I might not ever hold a broom the same again. So, any others? Should we move on?
The question I have in my head right now is, do we create dramas or ritual to affirm or reach for a certain lifestyle, or do we create a lifestyle that reaches for a drama or a ritual?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Another.
Or do we, can we do both? We do.
You know, what do you think?
I don't know. That's just the question keeps going in my head.
Which comes first?
The drum, the ritual, or the life? I like the question.
I like the question. There's a wonderful kind of a tension between the two. Mm-hmm. You know, out of some kind of a conversion that is the act of the grace of God, we create these rituals then that are almost the dream of the way of life we would live, and then the ritual itself then has the power of grace and to pull us more and more into this way of life. I mean, the Holy Communion certainly being an example. Does the communion first call us into this way of life, or did the way of life kind of create the Holy Communion?
I've been thinking about what do we do with the dead ritual? I mean, what do communities do with the dead ritual? Do they, once they realize that it's such, how do you bury one? How do you done with it? Move on? How does that work?
I think though, it's that tension again of is the ritual dead because there's something inherently dead about it, or is it dead because we don't hold those values anymore? And then we have to ask, go back to the whole values question. What are our values? What do we want our values to be? Maybe it's not good to ask what. It's good to ask what are our values, really, to see where we are, but then say, what do we want our values to be? And see where the gap is, and look at creating the ritual in such a way that it draws us toward that, closes the gap. To sort of reinforce, to remind you every so often that it's not where you are, but it's where you want to go. That is the reason you do it.
Another way of asking is, does the ritual need to be converted, or do we need to be converted? And that doesn't mean that we don't continually clothe the ritual in meaningful cultural forms. Yeah. And there are many. Once in Albuquerque, we accidentally scheduled an ecumenical Roman Catholic Episcopal Lutheran worship service right during the Super Bowl. In fact, the service started at kickoff time. Do you remember, were you there?
I think we accidentally did it the next
You mean where we had the Super Bowl? Or?
But partly, I suppose, ecumenism was rather new then, but the church was packed with all kinds of people that said, wow, are we glad for an alternative? You know, so there are probably many. And you're asking what...
Well, just so many people doing it now, you know.
Yeah, I think it could underscore the point is that you know, if the Super Bowl means nothing to you, the system is quite distant from what's being ritualized there. And then I'd say, well, then you can watch the Super Bowl as pure football. You know, and it won't seduce you. Well, here.
I just said the image that keeps coming to my mind is I keep seeing a picture, and it has to do with what happens when we place contradictory restrictions on a ritual that the original, well, that kind of contradict the ritual itself.
Mm-hmm.
And what I was thinking of specifically was communion. You know, when you say, let's share a meal, but only if you're...
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So you have to pass the test before you can share the meal.
Yeah, these are the people that may participate. You know, does that in itself counter the very thing the ritual is intending to dramatize?
Mm-hmm. And the other thing that comes to mind is to say that, you know, to go to a traditional church service where the architecture is set up so that we've got the pulpit way up here.
I
say everybody's equal here, we all have the same value, mm-hmm. but still we've got the pulpit up here and the altar, mm-hmm. and we're all down here. And that says something different than mm-hmm. what the worship's saying sometimes.
I remember being in the Holden community when we started age-inclusive communion, and how the ritual itself really just came to life in a new way just that very night. Because if there'd be a child sitting there, it was so obvious because you pass the bread around the rosary. You have to pass the bread over him as they're, you know, there was something about that action that countered the very thing, and how when that was changed, the ritual really took on new. So then that's another question, is how do we continually ask the questions about the ritual if it's really communicating the way of life that we have been given the ritual to dramatize. Am I saying that right? Okay. Now, what I'm going to do now the rest of our weekend is to just stop and go through the long story of a people throughout the pages of the Bible, and then at the end again to ask the question about a ritual. But in the meantime, before we go back to that question, let's just go through several thousand years of family history. Are you ready? Shall we take a deep breath? And we're going to go until, we started at, what time did we start? 7:15? So we'll go to 8:15 tonight. Okay. First of all, on my notes, I have this little warning label, like on a cigarette package, and it says warning. What we are going to look at is a way of thinking, a way of valuing that is vastly different than the way of thinking of our society. We're talking about a contrast society. This could be very dangerous to normality. Are you ready? This could be very dangerous to normality. Or as an author that's influenced me very much is Lohfink, the German scholar, in his book, Jesus and Community. Over and over he says what's being formed in Scripture is a contrast society. He uses the word contrast society that lives in the midst of a larger society as a sub-society with a different value. So that's the warning. Now, the invitation now is to come to the birthing of a people. And I'll start this way. Once upon a time, God Yahweh was extremely vexed. I like that word. God was extremely vexed with the society. And I'm going to describe how this society was set up. And God was especially vexed because God was being credited with this society in a way, which made God even more vexed. I like that word. But this society was set up with a God image at the top, and then under the God image, kind of a triangle, and then closest to God up at the top was a person called, are you guessing yet what society I'm talking about? Pharaoh's Egypt, and Pharaoh was on top and closest to God and ruled the society by divine right. Okay. Under Pharaoh were the bigger big deals. I don't like to use fancy language. And under them were kind of the lesser big deals. This would be kind of the administrators, the family of Pharaoh. These would be kind of the ordinary kind of citizen farmers, laborers, and then under them were the slaves. And then on either side, you had two figures that one is the priesthood and religion. And then over on the other side, you had the military. I beat on them. Okay, then the word of religion is this is the way it is. That's the purpose of religion. And just in case people start questioning this, you have over here, and the way it shall always be. And this is really, in a way, it's a short review of Paul D. Hansen's book called, help me, The People Called. And how he shows how religion in the ancient world, not just Egypt, but the religions of the society in which the biblical society formed, this was religion. That society was static, those on top were always on top, those on the bottom were always on the bottom, because this is the way it is, and it is the divine will of the gods that society should be this way, and life is to simply accept and to fit into one's place. And as long as this is working, so in the brains of all the people, there's a belief or a despair, be almost the same thing. In the heads of the people, a belief or a despair that this is unquestionable religious truth, then you really don't need this. But there's always a danger that somebody in their brain might start thinking, huh, maybe this isn't the way it always was. And then so you need this over here to be in a kind of a coalition between priest and soldier, priest and soldier, priest and soldier. And the martyrdom in Latin America and the persecution in Latin America from the military really started in its greatest intensity in the last quarter of century, when thousands and thousands and thousands of poor people in their heads started to question colonial theology, which was taught by the Spanish colonial conquerors, that the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob the God of the church has set everything up this way, with the Spanish overlords here and the indigenous peoples of Latin America down here. And to be a Christian is to fit into this system, to accept this truth, to never question it, and wait for your reward when you die. Colonial theology, it worked very well until maybe the last quarter of the century. Then the military had to be called in. Does that make sense? No? Thought I'd just bring it up to, this still, we're not talking about ancient history here. The other thing that was happening in Egypt was, and this really came from the powers against the slaves, was to continue in the minds of the slaves a sense of brokenness and discouragement and despair. And if you want to look in Exodus, that even when Moses spoke to the people about their freedom, this is Moses 6, 9, third chapter of Moses, Exodus 6. Moses repeated this to the Israelites, but they would not listen to Moses. So crushed was their spirit, and so cruel their slavery. And if you go back earlier in the first chapter, when the Egyptians make the decisions to crush the spirits of these. So that is another way the whole operation continues, is the crushing of the spirit, the crushing of any kind of hope, beating people into despair and discouragement. And if we have some time to do some more talking about what in our world today is called low-intensity conflict, or low-intensity warfare. Have you heard that, the term low-intensity warfare? That is, it's the war of the rich in this world against the poor, that you see especially in places like El Salvador and Guatemala, where we take the side of the rich in those countries against the aspirations of the poor. And one of the techniques of low-intensity warfare is to practice indiscriminate murder of people, not murdering people because they are leaders, not murdering people necessarily because they've done something, but simply picking out people to murder, and thus to crush the spirits of the whole people so no one will ever dare to ask the question, can things be different? If we can talk about that some more, if we believe in a God of history, the United States, in taking the side of the rich in the low-intensity warfare against the poor in our world today, we are asking for the judgment of God upon our nation. We're asking for the wrath of God, who sides, as we're going to see, with the poor of this earth. We're asking for judgment. We'll maybe, as we talk about this in contemporary terms, we'll come back to that. But it's a technique that was used in Egypt, and it is still used to this day. Now, in Paul D. Hansen's book, he doesn't use these words, but I have this picture of almost the kind of, I can't think of the word I want, the kind of, I'll think of it by tomorrow, I'll bring the word tomorrow. But it's a God who just looks at the situation and smiles, mischievous, that's my word, a mischievous God. It finally just says they're not going to get away with that. They're not going to get away with that. And the surprise of God is that this is not God's way. And in Exodus 8, Exodus 2. During this long period, the king of Egypt died. The Israelites, groaning in their slavery, cried out for help, and from the depths of their slavery, their cry came up to God, and God heard their groaning. And God remembered God's covenant with Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. And God saw the Israelites, and God took note. And then some words are lost in the most ancient manuscripts, so we don't know how that sentence ends. But it's like God sitting there with his clipboard, you know, and saying, Egypt, slaves, groaning, deep despair. God joins that despair and then just check, you know, I'm going to do something about that one. And out of what God does now is the birthing of a people. I don't have to tell the story again how God and Moses as partners irritated Pharaoh until the irritation reached the point when it was go, and then the Passover, the meal, and then moving out of Egypt, and then moving up to the Red Sea and Pharaoh changing his mind and sending the armies and the people trapped against the waters of the Red Sea. And then something happening there, like wind blew or something and dried up the water. And the people that were on foot walked across. And then the chariots and the horses of Pharaoh come and they get stuck in the mud. And the people on the other side up on the hill look, and there are the chariots stuck in the mud. And Egyptian soldiers stuck in the mud. And then I don't know if this would be the difference between Moses and Miriam, but Moses sings a song that's about 3 pages long in the Bible, and then Miriam puts it in one sentence. I like that. Sing to Yahweh, who is clothed in glory. Horse and rider Yahweh has thrown into the sea. And they're dancing up on the hill as the armies of Pharaoh are stuck in the mud. And then out of that Red Sea event, which sometimes it's called the primal story, the story that makes and births this people, God now is molding. Think of it as an infant now coming out of the water. Think of it like an infant coming out of the waters of baptism. But this is a people coming out of their baptismal waters, a people birthed. And now I'm going to draw a map and just ask the final question for our I like it. A map. Here's Egypt, kind of over here, am I right? And then how does this work? The map. The Sinai Peninsula is like that. This is. I have to look in the back of my Bible. Oh, not bad. Not bad. You got it? Sinai Peninsula, Egypt. The children of Israel and their slavery were probably somewhere around here. Here's the promised land. Now, when these people are birthed in this water event, and God has promised, has given covenant promise to these people, that God will bring them to a land flowing with milk and honey where they can live in freedom. Question. From here to here is about 200 miles. In fact, if you're on a tour since Egypt and the nation of Israel, you can travel between them now. The bus ride is about 5 hours. And if you took the Sabbath off, normal walking would be about 3 weeks. Why didn't, Egypt, when you're working with the Bible, you're trying to figure God out. You know, and we use humility and we use caution. Then we ask the question, and it's a faith question of God really birthing and forming a people. Why didn't God just give them 3 weeks to get to the promised land and they could take it over and be there? You know, and there's all kinds of maths of how they went, you know, something like this. They give it a try and then they finally come here. I mean, that isn't accurate. Kind of the spirit. You know, why all of this? Why wilderness? Why desert? Why wandering? Why bleakness? Why the dry and barren land? Why the 40 years? Why? What is God doing? Anybody want to take the leap?
Do we let these people be slaves?
Okay, the first would be, especially I think, to take the slave mentality out of the people. Like someone has said, it was easier to get the slaves out of Egypt than to get Egypt out of the slaves. This is not done overnight. What would another...
To just create their own identity as a people that know that they can pull this act off. Mm-hmm. And it takes a while to develop that.
Yeah.
All the social structures and the internal myths and things.
Yeah. Do you become a people overnight? The process, the stories. I'm kind of trying to think of it this way. If they would just have gone zap over to here, did they know any other way to run a society except the way everybody else did it? Everybody around them was running an Egypt-type society of hierarchy, of the big deals, the little deals, and the slaves. And then a religion surrounding all of this to assure that that's the way it would always be. And they had no more equipment than if they would have taken 3 weeks, walked across the desert to the land flowing with milk and honey, they would have set up New Egypt. New Egypt. And that's where we're going to move in our next session, and we're going to call it Going to the Wilderness School. And I'm going to tell you a secret, that when God got the people out into the wilderness, God did two things. One, God made covenant with them and made promises with them so they were together as partners. Well, three things. Secondly, God showered manna upon them at a very teachable moment so they would never forget. And then third, right in the wilderness, God set up several thousand little school desks. and they all sat in their school desks, and then in the front was a blackboard and a little stand, and then Moses, the teacher, stood up in front of all of those school desks, and he says, now we're going to take 40 years to learn a new kind of a society. A new kind of a society. And later the prophet said how this type of society connected to the promise to Abraham and Sarah. And that is that this society is going to live so differently than all the other nations. That the other nations are going to become tired of greed. And the other nations are going to become tired of oppression and the hierarchy of the big deals and the little deals and the oppression and the slavery and the bitterness and the hatred and the continued warfare. And those nations are going to look at this little people and their society. And then in the dream of Micah, the dream of Isaiah, they're going to say, hey, let's go to the mountain of Zion. Let's go to the hill of Jerusalem. Let's all together walk to Zion. And let's look up at that city. And those surprised people will be up there. And they'll say, we're not coming this time to fight, but we'd like you to teach us your way. Teach us the way of Yahweh. Be our teachers. And then Isaiah and Micah says, then the nations will beat their swords into plowshares. Then the nations will not learn war anymore. And each family will sit under their fig tree with no one to harass them. And then all of the animals will say, if humans can live in peace, we will too. And then there'll be a new creation. And then there'll be a ripple effect, and the entire cosmos will be redeemed. And the redemption of the entire cosmos will be because of a people who learn to be a contrast society. And the rest of the world said, hey, let's try that. And a miracle happened. And that's where we'll end tonight. And tomorrow we're going to go to that place in the wilderness where this strange stuff called manna falls. To that Mount Sinai, and then we're going to go to this schoolroom and see the kind of society they learned about and they learned to live.